Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. The music, of course, Tommy, I'm Free. The director of the movie version, Ken Russell, died just a week or so ago. And it's a selection of our guest, Gordon Bradbury, the mayor of Wollongong in New South Wales. Now, let me explain to you a little why here. The impact of the disastrous New South Wales state elections on the Labor Party continue to resonate. It sort of became the lightning rod for calls to reform that culminated in what many saw as a wimp out on the issue at the recent ALP National Conference. Well, of all the issues creating a smell around New South Wales Labor, one that lingered for years was that surrounding the city of Wollongong and its council. Not only individuals involved in criminal behaviour, but the perceived corruption of the basic civic process. The electoral fight in Wollongong pitched an experienced Labor campaigner and fundraiser, Noreen Hay, against a local hero, who also happened to be the long-serving minister of Wollongong Uniting Church, known as the Church in the Mall. Gordon Bradbury lost the state election by a squeak, but for perhaps his penance finds himself in the belly of the beast as mayor of Wollongong, leading a council that for many was the source of so much of the trouble. Gordon Bradbury, welcome to Sunday Night.
Oh, thank you. That's a remarkable introduction. It's been an interesting year, I can assure you.
Has the rot stopped in Wollongong?
Oh, I believe that it has, in as much that for the last 3.5 years we had administrators at council. They sorted out the mess, they turned the ship around, and as part of the Liberal Party's platform locally, they promised that we would go to the polls to elect a new council, that not only in Wollongong but Shell Harbour, which also experienced the same sort of thing. So as a result, on the 3rd of September, the people of Wollongong went back to the polls once more, twice in 1 year, and elected a council and a popularly elected Lord Mayor. So I got the gig, and here we go. And it is, they're a good bunch. Interesting group of people, diverse views, yes, for Labor, for Liberal, 2 Greens and 2 Independents, and myself as Lord Mayor, as an independent.
Money, development and local government seem a perennially potent mix. To what extent do you think Wollongong was emblematic of general problems surrounding councils and money in New South Wales or in Australia generally?
Well, you see, the difficulties come about when council gets permeated or infiltrated by those who think that it's an opportunity to further their own ends, and more specifically, those who are into real estate and property development and those sorts of things. And more specifically, where you have a community that shuts down, localises, become cocooned, the same old power elites start to get involved, and then they permeate not only the council but also the political process, as we witnessed in the New South Wales government, the last Labor government. You just had corruption of process, and there weren't adequate safeguards, checks and balances involved. There were lots of subjective judgments made because of basically pressure, and connections, those sorts of things. So local government as an instrument basically set up by your state governments, we're not recognised under the Constitution as a form of or level of government at this stage, but has been easily manipulated.
There is, of course, a deeper story at Wollongong in particular, and this may go to the question of why you chose to become involved in politics. It goes back, it's almost generational. One can recall 10 years ago the story of Frank Arkell, the murder of a mayor, accusations of paedophilia, the Crime Commission. So there's a thing about local community and power here as well.
Oh, indeed. And what happened here, look, it goes back to my days when I was at Wollongong University studying sociology. And we were given, as part of one of our assignments in industrial sociology or urban sociology, I can't remember the exact subject at the time, but we had a very perceptive lecturer and tutor. And Andrew Jakubowicz, his name was, I still admire him. He set us up as a group of students to go out and investigate who owns the gong. Now, I didn't live in Wollongong at the time, but it was interesting. We always had these sort of subsets to go and address. And I can remember vividly, it was towards the end of the year, and we were all called off. Because there's this group of students going around prying into things that they weren't supposed to, and we were all awarded a distinction for our efforts at the time. So we never even submitted our results, as I could remember, and it was the easiest distinction I ever got as part of my sociology program. So we obviously hit a raw nerve. But then when I was appointed the Minister of the Uniting Church down here in 1996, we were in the midst of a Royal Commission into police corruption. Wollongong was dragged into it. The incidents, as you already highlighted, of Frank R. Kell and the paedophilia situation and the tragedy that unfolded with that. And by the way, let me also say that Frank is still admired by a lot of people in this city for his efforts.
He was an extraordinarily popular mayor.
Yes, he was.
Just as a personality. Yeah,
that's right. And we had, but the point is that there were many who knew about this, and it's as almost as if there was a blind eye turned to this aspect of Frank's character, and also a previous Lord Mayor, Tony Bevan. So there was this history. There was also on the streets at time, we had a time I can remember it vividly. We had heroin problems because access to the port, the smell around council was building up. We had the local Labor Party's branch stacking. There was all sorts of things going on, and it's just been a litany, one thing after another since I arrived in this city. And then in the latest, with the dismissal of council and ICAC and all that. And by the way, if anyone wants to read a good story, just read the ICAC inquiries. So it's just been one thing after another. And then we had the state election coming up, and people said to me, we've got to do something. You know, the image of this city is just incredible. And I was having a stoush with the church at the time about an extension of call. That's another story.
Yes, but this is we could explain that an extension of call means whether or not they want you to hang around.
And yeah, well, that's right. And I was, you know, I turned 60 this year, and I thought I'd like to stay for another 5 years. They wouldn't be in that. The congregation wanted me to stay. The community wanted me to stay. The hierarchy of the church was being difficult. And then people said, Gordon, you've got to stand for the state parliament, you know. And they wanted me to stand for Kira, which was David Campbell's old seat. And I said, no, I've got to stand for the seat of Wollongong. It's more iconic. So then I put up my hand to stand as an independent against the sitting member, Noreen Hay. And as they say, the rest is history. Lost that by just 680 votes, with some other shenanigans that went on. And then we went to the Court of Disputed Returns, had that thrown out on a technicality, but as we contested, there were some irregularities in our election. And then, of course, the Liberal government got in. We then had the local government elections in the city brought forward by 1 year, which normally would be next year, September 2012, our elections have been brought forward for 1 year. The government said that they'd tack on an extra year on a normal four-year term. So I've actually been elected for 5 years. And we went to the poll, as I said, on the 3rd of September. And I had the bling thrown around my neck on the following Wednesday, the 7th of September, and
well,
hit the road running.
Yes, it hasn't got too heavy on your shoulders yet.
No.
You mentioned the state politics. You mentioned the Labor Party, because a lot of the smell was associated with the Labor Party. And, of course, that's played through into Labor politics up to the conference this week. But do you think this is a Labor Party thing, or something about the wider place of ethics in public discourse in this country? That is, for example, in business ethics over the last 30 years. You've seen a number of people say, oh, look, business ethics all used to be about three components, the shareholders, the public and the employees. Now it's narrowed down to the shareholders and even narrower to a particular group of shareholders, the corporate shareholders, and even so that narrower the board of directors. That is, we're getting a narrowing of this wider sense of public discourse. Is that what brought you into politics?
Indeed it did. And, you know, that... Look, the issue down here, for instance, was a classic. That is, it wasn't what you knew. It wasn't based on merit. It was who you knew, and that you had opportunities that were unfairly dispersed amongst the certain groups, and more specifically, certain developers. And as we all know, you could sleep with one of the town planners and get favours. That's how bad it got. So, but. The issue with the New South Wales Labor Party, I think Rodney Cavalier has done some incredible soul-searching and writing on this, but the New South Wales Labor Party has become dynastic. You know, it's like the family. And we know what happens when that sort of thing happens, that, you know, you come up through the ranks of the union movement, you marry into the tribe, it's all these favours, connections and things like that. That is not on. It should be based on merit, of transparency, of clear policies that can't be or need to be tested and rigorously applied, so that people feel that government is you know, they're entering into the process on a fairly even playing field, and that you're treated with a bit of respect, no matter who you are when you enter it. Look, one of the things I discovered about politics, and it's really important to remember, it's not a case of black and white. In terms that when people have an issue, there are merits on both sides of any argument, but they want to know that ultimately when the decision is made, it's made on the basis that there is a sound, evidence-based decision, that it's not random, it's not arbitrary, it's not subjective. I realise these things, these are high ideals, but you know, you've got to present a situation where government is based on clear, transparent and honest processes.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. John Cleary, with whom my guest is Gordon Bradbury, the Lord Mayor of the city of Wollongong in New South Wales, recently elected and for a long time, much of his life, as Minister of the local Uniting Church, the Church in the Mall in Wollongong. Gordon, let's have some more music that you've selected. Let's go back to one of the great pieces coming out of the Counter-Reformation. The wonderful piece scored by Mozart as a boy when he heard it in the Sistine Chapel, raced away and released it to the world, the Allegri Miserere.
That, to me, is one of the most uplifting pieces of music. It somehow or other has affected so many. When they heard it, they were lifted, they were transported.
And in sin hath my mother conceived thee.
The Allegri Miserere. You're on Sunday night. Our guest, Gordon Bradbury, Mayor of Wollongong, only recently elected, and after a long stint as Minister of the Uniting Church in Wollongong. Gordon, let's now go back and talk about that early journey, what led you to where you are. Your childhood and youth were not the average childhood and youth. You spent some period of your life in a Barnardo's home. Just take us back to your early development, your childhood, and what you learned through that process.
Well, as a child, all I can say is it was a pretty miserable existence. Both parents were alcoholics. They were people who had very limited education. But at the same time, I had three younger brothers. It became totally dysfunctional and just basically fell apart, so that ultimately we're in care in children's institutions from around about the age of 10 onward, ultimately into Dr. Barnardo's at Normanhurst, one of the northern suburbs of Sydney. My brothers continued on in that. In those days, you got your school certificate and you could leave at the age of 16 when you got your school certificate. Also, you could get a job in those days. So I launched out into being a laboratory technician, worked for a drug research company. But during that time at the children's home, you had to go to Sunday school. So there were two options. The Anglicans were further away. They were too far to walk to. The Methodists just happened to be on the nearest corner, so they got first choice. So, of course, my introduction to Christianity, but more specifically the dedication of people who, with their kindness and compassion, really showed me what true Christianity is all about. And I just want Christians everywhere to come back to this. It seems to me that it's so based on what you believe in terms of statements and theology and doctrines and things that many people equate with Christianity. But yes, underneath it all, it's based on those acts of generosity that move the human spirit.
Methodists can occasionally get a bit of a hard time for the stern, wowserish dimension. But the other side of Methodism was, as you indicate, and perhaps it's highlighted in Australian life by people like Sir Alan Walker, which was a sort of commitment to world transformation that comes out of the warmth of the heart rather than the sternness of the conscience.
Yes, well, they always go back and say of Wesley's conversion when he heard Luther's preface to the Book of Romans, you know, being read, and he felt his heart strangely warmed. Look, it's when people's hearts are warm that they change. And as far as I'm concerned, the old Methodist approach, or the type of Methodism that I was introduced to me to the notion of Arminius, that is the notion of grace, and its overwhelming power to transform lives. And I personally think that Christianity has lost its way when it gets so legalistic and tied down in its regulations and strict literalism. We serve a lavish God, and we should just get out there and be just lavish in our understanding and our generosity of spirit. And that's what won me for Christ, if I can put it in those terms. And then one thing led to another, and ultimately around about the late when I was about 19, I actually went to work with Alan Walker and Fred Nile at the Wesley Mission in Sydney. I was
contrasting duo. It's a little hard to imagine them in the same room together.
Oh, Fred doesn't like me these days, and there was some interesting responses from Fred when I stood for the state election. But anyway, that's another story. But at the same time, we worked together on what was called Newness Youth. It was a campaign, an evangelical campaign with young people, and I organised one of the first Christian outdoor rock festivals. And I was going to come back to my job at the time, but never returned, and I just continued working in the church as a youth worker, then went on to study psych and sociology down here at the University of Wollongong, which I think was very fortuitous, and then went to Sydney University and studied divinity and was ordained at the end of 1985. So that's a thumbnail sketch of the history of GB.
Let me ask you one other question related to that. That early experience, coming out of a broken home, then with your brothers, lots of people would say, but we've heard stories over the last 30 years about how bad those children's institutions were, sexual abuse, all sorts of sort of cruelty inflicted on kids. Mm. You're saying, well, yeah, that may be true, but there's another side to that as well.
Oh, indeed there is. And I do not want to sound like I'm diminishing people's experiences of institutional care, but we were very well cared for. And if you came from the chaotic background that I experienced, what they had to offer was just sheer heaven.
And did that apply to your brothers too?
Yes. Unfortunately, one of my brothers suffered more, I think, as a consequence of his childhood experiences. But that we were well cared for. There were moments where, well, in my own personal life, I was exposed to some abuse, but that was not through the institution. It was just one of those situations where we were allowed to go out with a particular individual who took advantage of myself, or tried to anyway. But then I was the sort of person who took up my own strength at a very early age, and if I felt I was being abused or challenged or threatened in any way, I retaliated. I think I was only 13 at the time, and this guy tried it on me, but I was able to, I just said, put him in his place and told him to get lost. So I'm not diminishing anyone else's experience, but I think very early in the bit, I had to take hold of my own destiny, my own direction, and my own morals, and what I wanted for me. And something in my life, it was like that. I also, if I could just illustrate the point, we had this wonderful Anglican priest who came to the school when I was in early primary school to give a scripture. I think he taught us two things, the Apostles' Creed and the Lord's Prayer. That's all I can remember. But there was one other thing that I do remember, and that is the story of Moses and the escape from Egypt and the crossing of the Red Sea the parting of the waters and how they all escaped, but also how the waters closed in on Pharaoh's army. This is my perverse mind. I was more concerned about the Egyptians who were drowned. And I just could not get my head around the idea of violence being the way that God would work. And that sort of destruction. You know what crossed my mind as well? All those mums and children that missed their dads. You know, that was really the start of the spirit of social justice and my fight for the things that are right in that regard. And it's just been an amazing journey.
That could take us into a whole other theological discussion.
Oh, about, sure, yeah.
About,
well, it is
the
a big
sort of
one.
Nature of God and violence and, yeah, and those, yeah, sorts of things. I'm going to put that one to one side, Gordon. I think we would probably wrestle with that.
Oh, that could go on for days. That one. We could be here for hours. Yeah.
Let's go back to your interiority and your contemplative model and have another piece of music while we'll allow others to perhaps think on that. This is Vaughan Williams. That Ralph Vaughan Williams, a sort of almost an agnostic saint. He's somebody who genuinely wrestled with his spirituality. Perhaps in his music you do get a hint of that that transcendent journey.
Oh, you certainly do.
And this one, probably one of the most popular. It's the London Phil under Sir Adrian Bolt, Hugh Bean at the violin, and The Lark Ascending. Why this?
Well, again, it's one of those things that describes your spirit soaring. I think that's probably why it's so popular. The skill of this composer to write music that connects with people's experiences and the sense of transcendence.
Well, here's just a hint of the transcendence of Vaughan Williams, The Lark Ascending. The Lark Ascending, a selection of our guest, Gordon Bradbury, the Mayor of Wollongong. Gordon, you explained to us a little earlier how your period at the Uniting Church was coming to a review. You move on, you move into civic politics. But what leads you from being somebody who is a minister concerned with the pastoral development of a community into making the internal judgment, quite independent of what the church is saying about whether they need you or not to continue, that politics is where you should move to? What leads you? Where's the sort of theological, spiritual, intellectual, moral journey there?
My understanding was But as a minister of the United Church, and more specifically one who was called into sacraments, and more specifically to minister to the community, look, I was doing something political anyway. I was out there fighting for the least, the most vulnerable, the little ones, as Jesus would put it. And so it just was a natural extension. I honestly can say that I sort of felt that I was prepared for this next step. When the church, the hierarchy of the church, wanted me to move on, the outcry in this community was immense. You know, my pastorate and my call was debated in the local newspaper for weeks. And I don't know how many letters were written to the editor, to the church, and so on over this. There was just a feeling that they wanted a pastor. There was a shepherd type role that I was extending out into the community.
The church in the mall had, in a sense, become a public forum already.
Indeed, and especially in areas of interfaith, working with the Muslim community down here. There we have a large Muslim community, and connecting that with them and their dialogue and their pain, as well as working with the Buddhist community, because we have a large Buddhist temple here as well. My approach has been that I'm a pastor to the community. Jesus never worked from a church. He worked wherever he was, and that's always been my approach.
I had a friend of say to me the other day, when he was talking to some young candidates for the ministry, that he recalls some words being written on a blackboard when he was about to graduate, and the words were, "You are not appointed to a parish, you are appointed to a community."
Indeed. And that's the tragedy of the church. It's in the 21st century, the church feels under siege. And what the mentality is, that it's circling the wagons, and like in the old westerns, and the heathen, postmodern, evil, atheistic forces are circling, and they have to throw rocks or arrows or whatever at them. But you see, when the church is under siege, it also becomes codified. Its documents, you know, let's face it, the canons were only formed and shaped when the church was trying to make sure that it kept the, more specifically in the Christian case, Aryan movement out and things like that. So, you know, when you're under siege, you get protective and you become cocooned. And that's what the church has done. And therefore, I was perceived as threat. I think as in some respects a threat. I am also a person who believes that it's about time we got back to the original Jesus, the Jesus message, and recovered who and what Jesus is and what he had to say, unleash the power of the original Christ and its implications for our lives and our community at the present time. That's all I did. And even in my position as Lord Mayor, the respect that I have for myself because I did that.
How does that impact on your behaviour? What then, finally, are your goals for the council, and how do you see yourself sitting in the chair and mediating that?
Well, in some respects, the figurehead for the city and representing its needs, its concerns. That's the civic role. Chairing the council is only part of the whole gig, but if I can put it in those terms, mediating, working with the other councillors. Look, people come from different political parties, but underneath it all, what they're trying to achieve is good things.
Yeah, but you're steering the ship of state, as we've indicated in this interview, out of some pretty torrid waters. You know, you have the shoals of we talked about, Labor Party corruption, venality on one side, but you've also got the developer community, as you've indicated, on the other side, and you've got a community that's been riven and torn between the two.
Yeah.
So what's your job in this? Now, what would you like to see your term end as and be marked by, I guess?
Well, at least in terms of process, that it's clear and transparent and people have access to every facet of the decision-making, so that it's, you know, whether it be through public information, access to information and so on, that the councillors are clear about their role. The one thing that I've emphasised and made very clear is that councillors are elected to set policy and strategic direction. The staff and the organisation are under the general manager, and the two should not be blurred. The council is also an instrument for the community, not for itself. And this is where it went very wrong in the past down here, and it's happened in other places. It became self-serving. The term hedonistic has been applied to what happened in the past here. So I'll be working hard and wanting to make it very clear. We don't overstep that boundary. Policy, strategic direction set by your councillors, its administration and implementation, that is under the province of your general manager. And as I said to you before, when we make a decision, that process is, or the arguments or the facts that led to that decision are obvious, not clouded or shaped by subjective opinions or pressure or who you know, that sort of stuff. That era is over. And I would like to be remembered as the mayor that led a council through its 5-year term and tried its best to make sure that that was the process.
Gordon Bradbury, perhaps we'll have the opportunity to check back in again sometime.
That's if I'm still alive.
Gordon Bradbury, we wish you well. Newly installed mayor of Wollongong, a ministry in a new place. Gordon Bradbury, thanks so much for joining us on Sunday night.